because they were more advanced, they thought, okay, we're better than you. You have to work for us. It shouldn't be the other way around. Like, dare you say that, you know, we're lesser beings than you.
So you're saying racism is closely linked to colonialism and imperialism?
Yes.
So it is essentially bullying. And actually, you defined racism quite correctly right there, because it is about, in a nutshell, one race deeming itself to be superior to another race.
Exactly. So you have many examples throughout history where, suppose, in whichever holy book it was written, oh, God's talking about us. We're the guys. The rest of you, you're at a lower stage, right? So I guess the basis of racism came from that. Instead of looking at one another as equals, what we're trying to do is we say, look, we're better than you, so you have to subject to us.
Yeah.
But in reality, we should all be subjecting to God as one, right? As one, suppose, group, as one set of like pieces in the basis of the world, right? As humankind in completion here, you should all be subjecting to God.
Yeah.
Not one another saying, oh, look, I got something that you don't. Because we all have our weaknesses. I don't think any group of people can say, oh, look, we're the best and we have no weaknesses. That's only God.
Sister Zainab, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think we have a proverb in our local language, in Kashmiri language, which means that empty drums make much noise.
Uh-huh.
So I think this superiority complex kind of thing comes into this. Something that's behind racism is superiority complex. And this superiority complex comes into the minds of these empty drums. The brothers said, kneel off the bottom. I went there and they were kneel off the bottom. They were nothing. When these people feel endangered, they get this complex that I am something, I am someone. But the more knowledge you have, you actually have, the more you're filled. If you are a filled drum, you will make much less noise. We have example of like, if we have a tree that bears more fruits, it is more down towards earth. And like, I guess the basic idea that's behind racism is superiority complex based on nothing, based on that empty drum.
And that's why it's increasing, actually, because these empty drums are making much, much more noise, their message is reaching further and to more people. I mean, I guess the racist ideas are easier to talk about. And when I say that, I have to be careful because people will think that I'm referring to blatant racism. I'm not. I'm talking about the subtle racism which exists throughout mainstream media. It's just the hegemonic idea of, for example, the white race being superior, you know, that hegemonic idea, which is unavoidable. You can't really escape from it. Wherever you look, you'll see the kind of white savior complex or themes of that nature shining through. Now what we're seeing is a backlash against the recognition of that, where white people are saying, well, I'm being targeted too. I'm being told that I'm inherently evil because I'm white. And they're right, because that is what some people are espousing. So racism is going both ways.
I now, think even yeah. the words that you used right now, right?
Yeah.
You said white people. You've already separated a group of people just based on what? On
color.
The way that they look. Mm. On like what they speak, right? But in the Quran, it shows that, look, all people are one of the same.
Except
in,
for taqwa.
Yeah. That we're all at the same level here, right? But what society has done now, and it's obviously it's getting worse, you're understanding a group or a culture through physical attributes.
We're speaking about, it seems like racism in this dark world all around us is increasing.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
See, okay, so do you believe that we should be colorblind? Because lots of people say that, you know, I'm colorblind. You look like a white person to me, even if there's a black person standing in front of them, right? And they'll be like, you know, I don't see you as brown. I see you as the same as me. But I'm not the same as you. I am different, you know. So should we be colorblind?
I'm saying there's a lack of understanding between people.
Ah, so right.
That results in us labeling people this or that depending on what we deem is okay and what we deem is not okay.
Yeah.
Right? Because the whole concept of racism came from, I guess you could say, it came from one group thinking, okay, look, these people were nice to me, so, you know, we're going to give them some respect.
Yeah.
These people, you know, they didn't help me out as much, so we're going to drop their level a bit. Uh-huh. Right? And that spread throughout history to an extent where now you have a group of people from a certain part of the world and they're deemed better, but with no basis behind it. It's just because of where they're from, what language they speak, the color of their skin, they have this quote-unquote superiority over someone who doesn't have these qualities.
Yeah.
But there's no basis behind, like, there's no difference. If you really look at these two people, there's no, like, substantial difference between the two.
So the Holy Quran says, Ya ayyuhan nasu inna khalaqnakum min dhakarin wa untha wa ja'alnakum shu'uban wa qabaila lita'arafu. I find that so beautiful. So it says, O mankind, we've created you into male and female and into groups and tribes so that you may know one another. So in other words, there are differences between you. Yes, you do have different colors, different skins, different genders. You know, you are all different. And we've done this so that you can recognize each other. Recognize. I think that a big part of the problem is the recognition is not there. There are certain people who are discriminated against because of the color of their skin. We have to try to feel that pain that those minority groups are feeling, whatever color they might be. But the next part of the verse is even more beautiful. It says, إِنَّ أَكْرَمَكُمْ عِنْدَ اللَّهِ أَتْقَاكُمْ. Surely the best of you with Allah are those who have the most taqwa, those who are always struggle pious. To find a...
The most pious.
Yeah, the most pious, those who fear Allah the most, or those who refrain from doing bad things.
When you perform the obligatory things and you avoid the what is forbidden.
Yeah, yeah.
So that way you become more pious, and if you know you are obeying Allah, you are...
So it doesn't matter which tribe or nation
you
belong
to. It doesn't matter. You know, it's we as human beings. It's beyond our imagination. We have divided ourselves on the basis of physical features, mm-hmm. basically. And dividing ourselves on the basis of physical features, we fail to understand the other person's, you know, inner side. And that's what Allah was saying in the same verse, that, you know, I want you to recognize each other, not on the basis of physical features. As long as I am not going to listen to a person, I cannot understand him. I cannot understand someone on the basis of his color, on the basis of his height, on the basis of someone else. These are the divisions. These are the, you know, racist things that we developed. And thanks to media techniques for that. We use so many media techniques in order to make a thing very bold, like a media technique called Big Lie. There's a media technique called Big Lie, and this so much works. For example, this technique was used by the United States while it was in war with Russia, I guess. I think. They said that Neil Armstrong went to moon, while as he never went to moon. No country was ever able to send anyone to moon. Did you know that?
Yeah.
So that's a big lie, but it worked. Yeah. It worked at that time. You know, it took US to some, you know.
Yeah, back then, though, they actually had a phone conversation live, and it was live broadcasted between the man on the moon and the president of the United States, and everybody was watching it live, and the president was picking up the phone and was like, oh, so you're on the moon, congratulations. And then the guy who was apparently on the moon was talking back, and people just believed it.
And yeah, like if I go to K2 mountain and I want to call home, I don't get signals, but I get signals on moon. That's amazing.
That defeats the whole purpose. If you can't get a signal here, how are you going to get a signal somewhere else?
Exactly.
That's outside of
it's like they suddenly erected telephone lines on the moon.
You got to go to the moon to find out.
It is so crazy. We'll be right back.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Media techniques that are being used to, you know, highlight an idea, they work a lot.
Absolutely,
they work on your mind, they work on your thoughts, they change your thoughts.
you've highlighted such a good point here, because it is about that big lie. Big lie, right? The thing. So if you tell a small lie, people might reject it. But if you tell a really big lie, people are more likely to believe it. That's the general idea. Really big, like 9/11, right? That kind of big. You tell it, people are going to buy it. Because the human mind can't comprehend that somebody would lie that much.
To such an extent.
Right?
Exactly.
But the idea here, bringing it back to racism, is the man landing on the moon, it was at the end of the day a white man, right? And so it plays into the narrative of, look, they are the dominant, better people. They are able to do things which you can't
you
do.
You cannot.
Right? They are the pioneers of the greatest sciences of the world, and they have lots of heroes and political figures as well who we all look up to and think that they are the actual people who changed the destiny of humanity.
No, you even look at, suppose, like children's shows. What did they teach children from a young age? Look, the hero is a white man, right? The area where he's from is a majority white, right? If you're colored, if you are from a different area, you have a different language, society doesn't accept you for who you are. You have to strive to be like the white man, right? Yeah. Any hero they've made for children, they're all white, right? Even like movies nowadays, the main character is white.
Yeah.
Just to push that idea that, look, what the white man can do isn't like at the same level. It's not on par with something a minority group, someone from a minority group.
It comes down to the whole idea of like scientific racism, the whole idea of eugenics, because they actually did promote the idea that certain races are better at certain things. So the white race is better at leadership. You, as a brown person, for example, you are better at driving a taxi. You're good at that. You're hardworking, and that's a good thing. If you're a black person, you're better at crime. You are better at that.
They justified their own beliefs here,
right?
And they've really pushed it, and they've taken it to such an extent where even someone who isn't accustomed to that just accepts it now. No one fights against this thing anymore.
Really interesting discussion that we've had, and we've barely even scratched the surface, but unfortunately we're out of time. From myself, from Sayyid Ja'far, and from Sister Zainab, we bid you assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-Alameen, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Hisham Abu Hawash has been refusing to eat for 141 days, but he's finally breaking his fast because the Israeli regime has agreed to release him next month. Abu Hawash has been receiving a great deal of support from the Palestinian people, who have rallied, protesting his unjust detention and demanding his freedom. And now these people finally have a reason to celebrate. In Al-Khalil, Abu Hawash's home, his supporters have turned out to rejoice this victory against Israeli jailers. His family had an especially tough time in recent days after doctors warned that Abu Hawash's health was deteriorating, that he was slipping in and out of coma and facing the danger of sudden death. Now they can finally breathe a sigh of relief.
I thank all the Palestinians who stood with us. Thanks to everyone who helped my brother. I thank God they released him.
During the past 3 days, we lived through a psychological war that was carried out by the Israeli intelligence due to what was happening with my brother Hisham. There were strong maneuvers, but we overpassed those as a family. Today, Hisham achieved victory for all the Palestinians.
Now, Abu Hawash's lawyer says he would be hospitalized for medical follow-up before his designated release on February 26. Palestinian officials have weighed in, praising his resistance.
Hisham Abu Hawaj prevails after 141 days of hunger strike. We hail Hisham for his forceful will, his family, Palestinian people, and people around the world who raise their voices in solidarity, thanks to countries that press Israel to release him next month on February 26th.
Resistance movements have also poured praise on Abu Hawaj, saying his victory should remind Palestinians how they can win every battle against Israel. The 40-year-old father of five children was arrested in October 2020 and started his hunger strike early 5 months ago to protest his detention without charge or trial that is allowed under Israel's administrative detention system. His lengthy hunger strike once again shed light on this illegal practice. Out of 7,000 Palestinians in Israeli jails, more than 500 are locked up without facing any charges or having a trial. For many of them, the last choice against this inhumane measure is to stop eating for lengthy periods of time. Still, the majority find themselves locked up in deplorable and non-standard conditions of the Israeli prisons, where they are sometimes even subjected to systematic torture and harassment.
In late 2020, Americans went to the ballots to pick the country's next president. 4 days after votes closed, Joe Biden was declared the winner. But the incumbent leader, Donald Trump, alleged vote fraud, and in doing so, shattered Washington's self-proclaimed image of the cradle of democracy. Trump adamantly refused to concede defeat after losing the 2020 presidential vote. On January 6, 2021, he called on his supporters to march on the Capitol and, quote, stop the steal. His fans attempted to do that. The world was shocked as news networks around the world showed thousands of Trump supporters forcing their way into the Capitol building, the symbol of U.S. democracy. Lawmakers engaged in the process of certifying the presidential election had to stop their task and flee for their lives. Some reports even suggest that a Republican senator was so frightened that he asked the Capitol security repeatedly to shoot the protesters. 5 people died in the chaos, one of them in the Congress building. To date, American authorities have arrested nearly 600 people and are looking for hundreds of more suspects. A big portion of the defendants stand accused of assaulting police officers. The FBI asked U.S. citizens to report each other out and tell the police if they knew anyone who had taken part in the riots. The incident inevitably had adverse consequences for the United States' image, both domestically and internationally. An opinion poll conducted last year by Harvard University showed that more than half of the country's young generation thought that American democracy is in trouble or failing. Moreover, an Axios survey indicated that now only 51% of the U.S. public thinks the next presidential election will be fair and free. Also, the Democracy Perception Index for 2021 showed that 44% of participants perceived the U.S. influence and meddling in the affairs of their countries as the biggest threat to democracy in their nations. At the same time, politicians and political analysts expressed shock and disgust at the chaotic scenes at the Congress grounds. Richard N. Haas, the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, said the attack signaled a post-American era. The assault on the Capitol changed the face of Washington, D.C. as well. The Congress building was fenced off on multiple occasions after the riots. Furthermore, Joe Biden's inauguration was carried out under heavy military presence, with an unprecedented 25,000 troops ensuring security. That was bigger than the number of U.S. forces present in Iraq and Afghanistan on the same day. The police reaction to the Capitol riots also raised questions about the U.S. law enforcement's differential treatment of white protesters. Whereas black people could be killed and injured for much smaller crimes, police were in fact criticized for their late and subdued response to the deadly protests by Trump's supporters.
Representatives of resistance groups gathered in Beirut to pay tribute to Iran's top commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, and senior Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. The two anti-terror icons were assassinated in an American drone strike outside Baghdad airport on January 3, 2020. Participants in the event all agreed that Soleimani united the region in the face of a common threat posed by the U.S. and Israel.
هذه الشهادة لم تقلل Their martyrdom did not weaken the resistance. On the contrary, it led to more accomplishments and success for the resistance. They are alive. This type of life is what gives a strength to the resistance. Martyr Qasim transcended his country to become the martyr of the entire nation, and this is an exceptional characteristic.
Hezbollah Deputy Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qasim stressed that people in the region will stand united and confront the threat posed by the United States. Meanwhile, the Secretary General of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad Movement, Ziad Nakhala, described Soleimani as the martyr of Palestine and Al-Quds.
The U.S. assassinated Soleimani because he was a barrier to American-Israeli plots in the region. He transformed the resistance fighters into a strategic threat to Israel and the U.S. I take this opportunity to say that we're proud of the positions of the Islamic Republic of Iran, which is unwavering in its support for the Palestinian resistance, and I witnessed that Qasem Soleimani was at the forefront of the fight in defense of Palestine and the people of Palestine.
The Iranian ambassador to Beirut also said that there is a joint Iranian-Iraqi judicial lawsuit being followed up by both countries to try the killers of the Iranian and Iraqi martyrs who were assassinated by the United States.
Resistance groups in the region consider General Qasem Soleimani as a man and a leader who united them. People in Lebanon, even those who knew him only after his martyrdom, see him as a man who transcended borders and sacrificed his life for the sake of the people and regional peace and stability. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
This international conference is the gathering of Islamic scholars converged in the port city of Karachi against Islamophobia. They believe Islamophobia is a Western project to reshape Islam with tools like Daesh and others.
Participants of the conference stressed on the need of unity among Muslims and called on the Islamic countries to take serious notice of the forces hell-bent to sow seed of discords among Muslim Ummah.
Documentary films during the past years over the gruesome acts of Daesh in the name of Islam were played to remind people how terrorist groups were weaponized by Israel and the U.S. to distort the face of Islam in the West.
Actually, Islamophobia is a project of Western country who do not like the Western people come to Islam like Islam. And they mention many things that hurt the heart of the Islamic people, while Islam is the religious of love between the people.
This conference is very important for me, all Pakistanis and all Muslims, because there has been so many cruel activities on behalf of non-Muslims or Western countries against Islam and Muslims.
Member of the international conference warned the Islamic countries to act quickly against the possible future threats given the previous experience with the West.
Islamophobia had been created to balance the teachings of Ahle Bayt alayhimus salam. It was created to balance and misguide people from the way of Quran and Sunnah. Things took place in the name of Daesh and so-called. And they did things which were absolutely against the teachings of Islam. They never understood.
The delegation in the conference also stressed the significance of the eradication of Daesh from Iraq and Syria to save Islam and also save humanity from the plague of terrorist groups like Daesh, which is seen as a Western plot against Islam and the Islamic community. Mohammed Turi, Karachi.
Britain's highest rank for chivalry, awarded by Queen Elizabeth to former Prime Minister Tony Blair, a man described by campaigners as one of the most repugnant political figures in the world, in power from 1997 to 2007.
The backlash to the announcement has been immense and is only growing. Furious Iraq War veterans are now calling for the honor system to be overhauled. And more than 500,000 people have signed a petition calling on the Queen to strip the man they call a war criminal of his new title.
It's a designation routinely awarded to former prime ministers here, but anti-war campaigners say they're repulsed at seeing Blair receiving it. And they have their reasons.
for millions of people in this country, it's an absolute insult, as it is to the people of Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, and various other places where we've now seen the war on terror over the last 20 years. And I don't see any justification for it whatsoever. I think that Blair never conceded that he was wrong about any of these things. The Chilcot inquiry, which was very, very critical of him, he immediately held a very long press conference afterwards and said he would do exactly the same again.
In mid-February 2003, just before the Iraq invasion, tens of millions of demonstrators in hundreds of cities across the world, including in London, marched against the impending U.S.-led war in the Middle East. To Tony Blair, the biggest protest march in British history was fatuous.
The fact is that had we been listened to and had Britain not taken part in the war almost certainly would not have taken place, that America would have been much less likely to go to war alone, and we would have seen a much different world today, a day where far more people would be alive as a result of that war not happening, there would be far fewer refugees.
The U.S. claimed the regime of former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein possessed weapons of mass destruction and actively pressed for invading Iraq in late 2001. The weapons were never found. Two decades on, 1 million Iraqis dead, 3 million dispossessed, and a region reeling from terrorism and instability. Hundreds of British troops were also killed in the same conflict. Anti-war campaigners say Tony Blair belongs in the dock at The Hague, and not in the pantheon of great leaders. Saeed Purreza, London.
Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah lashed out at the United States as the mother of corruption and terrorism in the region and stressed that the expulsion of U.S. forces from the region will be the final revenge for the U.S. assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi Popular Mobilization Unit's commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in Baghdad in 2020.
We have declared earlier that the best revenge is the full withdrawal of U.S. troops from the region. And over the past 2 years, as the leader Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei said, the U.S. has been forced to leave Afghanistan with humiliation. This has led the U.S. allies to rethink their alliance with Washington.
In an address to a ceremony in Beirut remembering the martyrs Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis and their companions, Sayyid Nasrallah also accused the U.S. of being behind all Israeli and Saudi crimes in the region for decades.
The lesson which I would like to highlight today is that everyone acting for the sake of God emerges victorious in all battles and wins the hearts and minds of all people across the Arab and Muslim worlds. They show us that the U.S. serves as a real enemy and source of corruption, occupation, and terrorism in our region.
Allies believe that the project of the resistance continues to face the criminality of the U.S. in Lebanon and the region.
Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani belongs to the school of thought of a struggle against the occupiers of our land and those who destroyed our homes and killed our people and led one war after the other with their support for the Zionists. He sacrificed his life and stood against terrorism in Iraq, Yemen, Syria, and Lebanon and Palestine. He taught us that Lebanon is strong enough and can remove itself from the U.S. hegemony.
The leader of the resistance stressed that the assassination of martyr Soleimani, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, has triggered a new phase at the regional level.
The assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and PMU commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis is seen as an incident larger than the region itself, and for many analysts has brought to light a long-term confrontation for Lebanon's Hezbollah facing U.S. influence in Lebanon and the region. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani is highly respected among Afghan people because of his leadership role in resisting invasion and Takfiri groups in the region. Afghans consider him as a hero who inspired them to find freedom and defeat the invaders. To commemorate Lieutenant General Soleimani's sacrifices and bravery, Afghan leaders, clerics, and experts gathered at the Iranian embassy in Kabul, highlighting his role in unifying Muslims and forming an anti-terror resistance in the region, especially Afghanistan.
In Shahid,
Martyr Soleimani was a righteous servant of God. He was committed to Islam's holy values and ideals, so he devoted his life to serve Muslims and the oppressed and fight devils and takfiri groups. He fought the US hegemony in the region and didn't let it interfere in Islamic countries' affairs and create terror and war in the region.
Shahid Qasim Soleimani.
Martyr Soleimani managed to unify Muslims around the globe. He always used to show up wherever he was needed. For Afghanistan, he was a friend. He met resistance forces and Afghan top leaders to motivate and empower them to defend their soil against terrorists and invaders. Therefore, we owe the victory over the US to the anti-terror, General Soleimani.
Some Afghan teenagers, considering themselves as the followers of Lieutenant General Soleimani's school of thought, have held a Sunday Wushu match on the occasion of the second anniversary of the martyrdom of their fearless role model.
Our match is held here in support of Commander Soleimani. We, the young generation of Afghanistan, are followers of his school of thought. We love the commander's attitude and adopt him as our role model in bravery, faith, and modesty. That is why most matches are named after him.
Lieutenant General Soleimani not only played a major role in defeating Daesh terrorist group in Syria and Iraq, but also had a direct relation with Afghan resistance forces to help them defeat terrorist groups and put an end to invasion on their soil. Afghans mark the second anniversary of the U.S. assassination of the anti-terror commander Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, as they are still suffering from time-to-time Daesh attacks. For Afghans, Martyr Soleimani is a hero and a role model for fighting against terrorism. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The second anniversary of the assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani was marked with a lecture which detailed the life and good works of the former leader of the Quds Force of Iran's Revolutionary Guards Corps. The participants praised the sterling quality of his character, especially his selfless fight against terrorist groups.
He was keen for his fight against this terrorism. And he need to be remembered. We must remember General Qasem Soleimani for his bravery and standing against injustice. He fight against the extrajudicial killing of innocent people by the so-called ISIS and other terrorist organizations.
General Soleimani and his fellow Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis were assassinated in a targeted drone attack on the 3rd of January 2020 in the Iraqi capital, Baghdad, with orders from then US President Donald Trump. People here say the assassination of General Soleimani has revealed the true identity of terror sponsors to the world.
Those that claim to be fighting against terrorism kill a hero, somebody who fights against terrorism. Now, who are the terrorists? America is the perpetrators of terrorism in the world. It is very clear to the whole world that these are the global sponsors and perpetrators of terrorism in the world.
Military hospital.
In a message to the occasion, Nigeria's senior Muslim cleric Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki said the Islamic movement in Nigeria will continue to mark the assassination of General Soleimani, just like it marks other martyrs in Karbala, Zaria, and other places. Nigerians who gathered here say they share the pain of the Iranian people and indeed of all law-abiding nations of the world who stand against extrajudicial killing like that of General Qasem Soleimani by the U.S. government. Danjum Abdullahi, Abuja.
After almost 140 days of his hunger strike, the 40-year-old Palestinian prisoner Hisham Abu Hawash is in imminent danger, facing the risk of sudden death at any moment. Representatives of Palestinian factions and prisoners' advocacy groups in the occupied Ramallah took to the streets again, sounding the alarm over the health condition of Abu Hawash, who is protesting his illegal administrative detention without charge or trial.
My brother Hisham could die at any moment. This is according to medical reports by the doctors who have directly examined Hisham. We are really worried about his health. Israel is using a new form of assassination against our brothers.
The International Committee of the Red Cross has meanwhile issued a statement demanding Israel to immediately release Abu Hawash. Israel claims it keeps some Palestinians behind bars without disclosing sensitive information that could expose valuable sources. In the case of Abu Hawash, Israeli intelligence claims he's an activist of the jihad movement. However, it was not able to provide explicit evidence in support of its allegations. Palestinian human rights organizations say it's yet another attempt to bring Palestinian prisoners to their knees and prevent them from being engaged in any form of struggle.
My brother Hisham could die at any moment. This is according to medical reports by the doctors who have directly examined him. We are really worried about his health. Israel is using a new form of assassination against our brothers.
Last month, the Israeli regime accepted to release hunger-striking prisoner Kaid al-Fasfus after 131 days of his protest, where his release was seen as yet another form of victory. As Israel reportedly holds over 4,500 Palestinian prisoners, hundreds of them are languishing behind bars without charge or trial under the illegal so-called administrative detention. Palestinians pray that Abu Hawash's life could be saved before it's too late. Abu Hawash, who's literally on the verge of death, has said before his health severely deteriorated that he will continue his hunger strike until victory. That is, according to him, his release or his martyrdom. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Mounting challenges will make the coming months critical for President Biden's environmental agenda, analysts say. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Lisa Friedman, who reports on federal climate and environmental policy. The piece is titled, Biden Overpromised and Underdelivered on Climate. Now trouble looms in 2022. As the new year opens, President Biden faces an increasingly narrow path to fulfill his ambitious goal of slashing the greenhouse gases generated by the United States that are helping to warm the planet to dangerous levels. His Build Back Better Act, which contains $555 billion in proposed climate action, is in limbo on Capitol Hill. The Supreme Court is set to hear a pivotal case in February that could significantly restrict his authority to regulate the carbon dioxide that spews from power plants and is driving climate change. And the midterm elections loom in November, threatening his party's control of Congress. Since Republicans have shown little appetite for climate action, a Republican takeover of one or both chambers could freeze movement for years. The mounting challenges make the next few months critical to secure the safety of the planet as well as President Biden's climate legacy, analysts are saying. If they can't pull this off, then we have failed. The country has failed the climate test, said John Podesta, a former senior counselor to President Barack Obama and founder of the Center for American Progress, a left-leaning think tank. Mr. Podesta praised the Biden administration for making a global warming a priority, creating a White House Office of Domestic Climate Policy, appointing an international climate envoy to reassert U.S. leadership on the global stage, moving forward a handful of regulations and proposing major investments in clean energy. But John Podesta also noted that the physics of climate change is unforgiving. The planet has already warmed an average of 1.1 degrees Celsius compared with the temperatures before the Industrial Revolution. If temperatures continue to rise past 1.5 degrees Celsius, the likelihood of the increasingly deadly wildfires, floods, heat waves and other disasters becomes unavoidable, scientists have warned. Countries must immediately and drastically reduce their greenhouse gas emissions caused by burning of fossil fuels such as oil, gas and coal if the world is to avert the most catastrophic impacts, experts are saying. At international climate talks in Glasgow last year, President Biden pledged that the United States, the world's biggest polluter in historical terms, would cut its emissions at least 50% below 2005 levels by the end of this decade. He urged other countries to take similar steps, but that will be a hard sell if the United States fails to act by the time countries gather for the next climate talks in Egypt this November. If you can't meet the goal, you've lost credibility internationally, John Podesta said, adding that he would grade Joe Biden's first year on climate policy as an incomplete. When he entered the White House, Joe Biden identified climate change as one of four priorities, along with battling the coronavirus pandemic, strengthening the economy, and addressing racial inequity. It was a dramatic reversal after the tenure of President Donald Trump, who frequently mocked climate science, sought to expand oil and gas drilling, and loosened a raft of environmental regulations, including those governing greenhouse gas emissions. The most important thing that Joe Biden did was to draw a sharp contrast with his predecessor within the first days of his presidency, said Senator Chris Coons, Democrat of Delaware, who has close ties to President Biden. Mr. Biden immediately rejoined the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement, in which nearly 200 countries pledged to try to hold temperature rise well below 2 degrees Celsius. He cancelled permits for the Keystone XL pipeline, which would have run 1,209 miles from the Canadian oil sands to Nebraska. He paused new leases for oil and gas drilling on public lands and in federal waters, and called for increasing renewable energy production, with the goal of doubling offshore wind power by 2030. Joe Biden installed long-time climate advocates in key positions and made tackling the climate crisis a priority across the federal government. The early flurry of efforts culminated in a virtual summit in April, at which Joe Biden corralled world leaders to make new pledges to cut carbon dioxide emissions. On Capitol Hill, though, President Biden led passage of a $1 trillion bipartisan infrastructure bill that included billions for clean energy research and making communities more resilient to disasters, although it will do little to reduce carbon emissions. However, cracks in President Biden's agenda quickly appeared. In June, a federal judge in Louisiana sided with the Republican attorneys general from 13 states who argued that Joe Biden lacked the legal authority to pause new oil and gas leases. As gasoline prices surged in the summer and fall, the White House sought to increase oil production, even as President Biden implored world leaders to stop burning fossil fuels. Just days after the Glasgow climate talks, the Biden administration auctioned off nearly 80 million acres in the Gulf of Mexico, a record for that location, for offshore drilling, despite a campaign promise by Joe Biden that he would end drilling on federal lands and federal waters. White House officials said they were legally compelled to hold the lease sale, which the Interior Department said had the potential to yield 1.12 billion barrels of oil and 4.4 trillion cubic feet of natural gas over the life of the 50-year leases. But environmental groups, joined by several Democratic lawmakers, argue that the Biden administration could have done a lot more to prevent the sale and are suing the administration to stop it. Most notably, Joe Biden failed to persuade the single Democratic holdout, Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia, to vote for his $1.7 trillion Build Back Better bill, placing its future in jeopardy in an evenly split Senate. The House passed the package back in November. In negotiations with the White House, Joe Manchin insisted that the Biden administration strip out the most muscular part of the bill, a clean electricity program that would have rewarded electric utilities that stopped burning fossil fuels in favor of wind, solar, and other clean energy, and penalized those that did not. Joe Manchin also scuttled a provision that would have prohibited most offshore oil drilling. The legislation still contains about $555 billion for other climate provisions, including $320 billion in tax incentives for producers and purchasers of wind power, solar power, and nuclear power, inducements intended to speed up a transition away from oil, gas, and coal. Analysts say it would help the United States to get at least halfway to Joe Biden's climate goals. The future of the legislation remains uncertain, although Senate Democrats said on Tuesday that they were determined to see some version of it passed this year. Objectively, he overpromised and underdelivered, said Kevin Book, managing director of Clearview Energy Partners, a Washington-based research firm. Still, Kevin Book added, while the administration did not do as much as President Biden had promised, it has taken significant first steps. However, many activists are saying they were disenchanted with the president. Joe Biden started strong with the executive actions back in January, and since then he has really been a disappointment, said Ellen Scales, a spokeswoman for the Sunrise Movement, a youth-led environmental group that helped spur a jump in young voters concerned about climate in 2020. Ellen Scales said she feared it would be difficult to turn out those voters again in November. He made a lot of promises on cutting emissions, and we question whether or not that's on track, she said, adding that it was a slap in the face to environmentalists when Joe Biden went to Glasgow to declare the United States a climate leader, only to quickly lease millions of acres in the Gulf of Mexico to oil and gas companies for drilling. Meanwhile, the Biden administration has been slow to make progress on major new environmental regulations, in part because agencies were hollowed out during the Trump administration, leaving a crush of work to fewer people. Manish Bapna, president of the Natural Resources Defense Council, an environmental group, said he saw 2022 as a make-or-break year. "Most of the hard work remains ahead of us," Manish Bapna said.
Seven barometric pressure.
We come to you, and O God, knowing that thou art our only King.
You're listening to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillahi ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners. Welcome to another episode of Bookshelf. on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. One of the modes of communication is by use of metaphors, by use of similes, by use of examples and parables. And by doing so, we are able to make our audience or make that person who we are aiming to make understand our point, understand it easier and better. So therefore, we see that in the Holy Quran or in the glorious Quran, there are many instances where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gives parables, gives examples, in order for the understanding of a very intricate point, a very deep concept, to be understood easier. And this is something that we are taught, that the Holy Quran does so in order to make people understand. Therefore, when we are speaking, it is also wise and it's also worthy for us to actually use this particular tool to make people understand. The book that we would like to introduce basically is all about that. It has taken examples and parables and similes, metaphors, and has used them in a manner to explain very detailed and intricate points, but in a very simple manner, in order for anybody, even with a very limited means of understanding, to understand the concept, even at a very low level, but at least grasping the concept, and obviously putting the responsibility on the shoulder of that person if they want to get a better understanding, to go and research further. So the book that we would like to introduce to our dear brothers and sisters today is based on this concept, the concept of giving examples and giving, you know, metaphors and similes in order for people to understand concepts better. And hopefully in our next segment, inshallah, we will be introducing it. So please stay tuned.
Why do we read books in the first place? What are books good for?
We read books because we don't want to reinvent the wheel, if you will.
We'd better take advantage of human cultural and intellectual heritage, particularly related to our daily activities, such as our physical, mental, spiritual, or even religious health.
We can't ignore the past thoughts and experiences. To do so, we need to boost our bookshelf.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. As mentioned previously, the book that we would like to mention and introduce to our dear listeners is titled Parables, Important Questions, Simple Answers. The book is a compilation of some of the statements and TV programs of Sheikh Mohsin Qaraati, who we have spoken about many times on this program. And the book was translated by Samir Al-Hakim. So the translator himself, and it was published by Ansarian Publications in Qom, Iran. But it was also published by another publication. I can't remember the name of that one. But I know that this person's book is available from Ansarian Publications. But anyway, the translator himself speaks about this book and says that Hujjat al-Islam Mohsin Qaraati, in his televised program Lessons from the Quran, is using parables and similes. So those concepts and parables and similes that Sheikh Qaraati used in those programs were very successful. And they were very successful in getting a message across and making people understand. So therefore, in this publication, the author himself selected 100 of the many similes and parables he has conveyed. So he has used these parables in his TV programs. But here he has taken those parables and used it under a particular question that he feels the parable answers. So this is what he has done. So in this publication, the author has selected 100 of the many similes and parables he has conveyed and presented them in a question and answer form. So for example, he will be dealing with a particular question. Under that particular question, which is obviously either in beliefs or in history or whatever, 100 of those that were used on this TV program, Lessons from the Quran, were brought and were therefore then translated afterward by the dear Sayyid, Sayyid Samir Al-Hakim. So inshallah, in our next segment, we will be reading a portion of this book for the benefit of our dear listeners. So please stay tuned. Thank you.
using the sacred texts we have received to help us understand where we came from and where we are going as a human race, are most rich in helping us find our direction. They narrate stories of our past. But where have they brought us? Where are their messages now? Are we the people of belief, or have we become the people of the boxes? Is there wisdom trapped in our bookshelves? Bookshelves, bookshelves, bookshelves.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. The book that we have introduced to our dear listeners is titled Parables, Important Questions, Simple Answers. The book was compiled by Sheikh Mohsen Qaraati from some of the parables he used on his TV show and was then translated by Sayyid Samir Al-Hakim. The book is available from Ansarian Publications. So we will begin with obviously the first question. And as we said, the book is formed and compiled in the form of question and answer. So the first question: why did God create the world, mankind, and everything in it? If a well-versed scientist gives an excellent speech, one will not question why was such a good speech given by this expert. Because he has the knowledge and expertise in the field that he is able to express his views. However, if this same scientist, with all the experience and knowledge, remains silent, the question will then be why nothing was said. God has the ability and wisdom and mercy to create from soil wheat, and from wheat the germ, or in this the translator used the word sperm. It's the germ. And from sperm a complete human being, unless he meant the sperm that is in the human being after the human being eats it. So God has ability and wisdom and mercy to create from soil wheat, and from wheat sperm, and from sperm a complete human being. And if he did not create this complete and perfect creation, the question should in fact be, why is it that with all his power to create, he did not? Question 2. What is the role of faith in God in the life of mankind? If you enter a house in which you know this place has no owner, nor is there any accountability, nor any cameras watching over your actions, nor having control over your actions without any trace of system or mandate over what you do, in such an unrestrained and unhampered free environment, whatever discipline over our actions and control over ourselves will be considered to be to our disadvantage. However, if we know that this house has an owner, and that we are accountable with all our actions under full view of the owner, we would certainly act differently. Faith brings us this, an owner by the name of the wise God, taking accountability for our actions in the name of the day of resurrection. For all our thoughts, actions and words, there are rewards and punishments. And we too will take account of our own actions and make an effort to thwart any rebellion. Any action in which the owner does not like, we will not do, because we know we will be accountable for our entire actions, be they good or evil. And God is ever waiting in ambush, that is ever watching over us. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to enable us to act upon the wise and wisdom that He has presented for us in the Holy Quran, in the glorious Quran, and in the Ahadith of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, and to grant us a deep understanding of these deep principles as well, inshaAllah. Until our next time, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Bookshelf on RIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim.
Thank you. www.parstoday.com/en.